I'm telling you though, because of my trip to Denmark, my time schedule has shifted to what would be more to a normal person schedule rather than a sloth.
When you text me and said, I'm waking up at 8 o'clock every day, and I'm thinking, I'd love to wake up at 8 o'clock every day.
It'd be
great.
Look at me, Paul Harris. I'm very productive. I have a household to run, and you know, the 9 to 5.
No, it's not that.
You know, Dolly Parton playing in the. Yeah,
no, it's not even. I wish I was being productive before 8 o'clock. I'm not being productive. I'm just awake.
I don't know how you do that. Honestly, again, like if you. And by the way, you know, jokes aside, I feel no guilt in being the type of person that like sleeps until. If you leave me to it, I will sleep until 8, 9, 10 sometimes. But then I'll work until 2 a.m. And I'll be perfectly fine with that. And I don't subscribe to the belief of, like, you know, the 5 a.m. club. Oh, gosh, I hate that so much. I tried it. I tried it for many years. I tried it for at least 2 years, back to back when I was at uni, to be that person. Because I'm like, oh, you have, you know, that this is the way, right? This is how we are productive. No, this is not the way we are productive. This is the way you become very unhappy with your life.
It's not.
If you're trying to maximize misery, that's how you do it. You wake up at 5 a.m. when you are not the type of person to wake up at 5 a.m.
Precisely, which is my whole issue when I see anybody saying, here is my schedule. And I'm like, I'm glad that you have worked out what works for you, but it would not work for me. Is generally, I would say, my kind of feeling. And I think I've always been an early riser. My first job was like paper round, right? So I would be up at 6 and then at home and then off to school. But I also completely get it that some people work. I personally, and I have found this very recently, trying to put more time into things like my newsletter, that I cannot write after about midday. And I don't know what it is. It's not like I can't. I can, but I'm just a lot more sluggish. So my productivity happens between the hours of like 8:30 and 11 a.m. is when I'm at my kind of optimum. But if I have a call that goes from 10 to 11, I kind of go from feeling like I have the whole day ahead of me to feeling like, oh, the day is gone.
Yeah. No, it's an energy reservoir, right? You only have so much focus in the day to actually get things happening. And for me, it's a very similar thing, right? And that's why. This is one thing, by the way, that all of the productivity gurus have nailed, which is get the things that are most important and require the most amount of energy earlier in the day before you have to do anything else, including responding to email, including talking to people, including anything else. Do like a like 2 hour focus time to do the actual high quality stuff you need to get done, because otherwise throughout the day it never happens. Even though, funnily enough, I get a second boost of energy in the evenings. So if for example, for whatever reason, be it, you know, we have a recording or we have something else throughout the day in what will be my quote-unquote peak times in the morning, I will then have like a secondary sort of wave of energy in the evening, which I'm like, oh, okay, now I can actually do this sort of stuff and I can refocus again. And it's actually a lot easier at that point because I feel like the world has gone to sleep now. And I don't need to. I don't feel compelled to respond to people or emails or anything at like 8 p.m. And it's like, yeah, no, that's me time now. I will do that. It's either that or RimWorld. So pick and choose.
Yeah.
I'm still doing RimWorld, by the way. That has not
that's
stopped.
Good.
I don't know if it's good.
It's good for you. I don't know. I think that thing about the world is asleep. I feel the same way about, again, the world is not yet awake. But I do sometimes find myself going down a route of, like, I'll finish work at 5. And then I have my, like, 5 to 7-ish, which is family time, sort the kids out, put them to bed. And I will sometimes come back to my desk and I'll, like, do the kind of admin stuff that has been clogging up my day. I've done this kind of for a while and I kind of find it works. And it's a thing of, oh, I'm not working in the evening, but I'm also like, actually, if I spend 40 minutes in the evening just clearing out my inbox, I will feel so much better the next day. And I'm like, you know what, it gives me that thing, it means that I'm actually just getting more stuff done. in that time. So one of the things about being in this job, which I never really talk about, and it's funny because me and Lydia connected because we are both in the world of pre-sales, and we kind of allude to it sometimes, but we never talk about what we actually
yeah,
do.
Yeah, you know this pre-sales podcast that we're doing? Yeah.
It's a tech podcast. It's like a pre-sales adjacent technology stuff.
When both of us are in the space, it seems awfully weird that we don't really talk about it very often.
It's
almost like, as exactly said, like, you know, the thing that got us together and the thing that we both are really passionate about and talk about it all the time off air, it's like, yeah, let's maybe try to talk about it on the podcast. That would be great. What a brilliant idea. Nobody would ever thought about that.
I think it's funny because I guess we've both been on other pre-sales podcasts. Not to kind of turn this into a bit of a podcast loving, where we talk about that thing of the massive cliche of people on a podcast talking about other podcasts they've done. But we both have, and they'll be linked in the show notes. And I think those, at least for me, I feel like my journey to pre-sales is pretty well documented. It's out there. And I've told it a bunch of times. And it's when we started this, I was like, there's not really, I didn't really feel the need to sort of retell it. But I do wonder if people are listening who are maybe not in pre-sales or are like, when they talk about that, what is it? I would probably still come back to your thing to do, which is you make complicated stuff easy to understand, which is kind of it.
It's very catchy. I would call out a friend of the show, Don Carmichael, and his, which on his business card he says the person you actually want to talk to.
This is very true.
Between I make complicated things easy to understand and the actual person you want to talk to, those two things together is what a pre-sales person is, really.
Taking a break, and I think particularly in this role of pre-sales, there's a lot of conversations like, oh, it's such a great job and it's the job that no one tells you about. It's also really quite hard. And that's the thing that I don't, not to be all worries me, but it's a tough job.
Oh, you it's do it. You job. Go in and you do a demo and people listen to you and then you do some BUCs and then you get a lot of money. Like, it's not like a real, you're not, oh, my favorite one, you're not a real engineer. Right.
Because, you know, engineer is a protected term.
Is it? I don't think
apparently.
It is.
I don't know. If we spend half the energy that gets expended on discussing what you should call pre-sales professionals on actually growing and investing in this profession, I think we'd be progressing faster.
By the way, on that front, I do think this whole, like, how are we called thing, it's a very much of a silo problem that we're having. It's a thing where you have a lot of people who are very passionate about a thing talk to themselves in a echo chamber, which is social media, and you feel like this is a constant conversation that the world is having about the thing that you care about. And in reality, if you step just one step outside of our little circle of pre-sales fangirls and you look at companies that do have a pre-sales team in one way or another, they could not care less about how it's called.
That it's defined by what you do, not what you're called. That's always what I say. Whenever I see we are in a crisis of identity, and it's like, yeah, because I think we can be, in terms of like what our role is and what we actually do. How I think about it, I'm coming up on 5 years in pre-sales, and it's changed massively what the like perception of what it is, or at least I think outside of the bubble as well, because of selling motions have changed, but no one really, as you say, outside of this little like bubble of people, and it's kind of it's a silo within a silo as well of people that actually have these kind of hand-wringing conversations.
Oh, that was that it?
No, sorry, yeah, that was it. I was.
I thought you were going to go down a rabbit hole. I'm just sitting here.
I'm trying not to go down the rabbit hole.
I was sitting here bracing myself. I was like, yeah.
It's because I'm not on video. To be fair, I feel about rants. One of my favourite film critic and one of my favourite podcasts is called Mark Kermode. He's famed for his rants, and people have whole YouTube playlists that are just him ranting. So I'm in good company being a man that rants on podcasts.
That should be our subgenre. Yeah. The main genre is the one I keep referring to as two dudes talking, which, by the way, dude is a gender neutral term. You can be a dude as a woman. So
okay, yeah.
So we have the two dudes talking genre, and then we have the endlessly ranting about minuscule things subgenre. Turning the camera off has made me more unhinged for some reason, and I don't know
why. It really has.
That's why I said, no, it's a feeling, right? The two dudes talking genre is a feeling of a podcast. It's exactly this, which, you know, of being the third person, being the third wheel in a conversation that you cannot participate actively in, like, you know, as it's happening. But it's cool anyway. Most of the positive feedback we're getting is around how casual and how sort of nice to listen to this podcast is. Even with Paul's rants, it's still fine.
Even with my rants. Well, that's a bonus episode right there, right?
Good.
Compilation of Paul's rants.
Oh, yeah. No, easy for you to say, because I'm the one who's going to have to extract all of the ranting from everything that we've recorded so far and edit it into one big long thing.
I'm
sure this is still going to be cut out. You have no idea.
I know.
Because if I leave it, people are going to go like, ooh.
I know.
That will be really, really fun to listen to Paul rant for, like, on random topics, including trains, pre-sales, and productivity. Amazing.
Going camera off has definitely made us both more unhinged.
Yeah, but it's also I think this is great. I think we should do this as a default.
camera off, and then at some point we'll do a late night record,
which
will be just completely like off the charts.
Oh no, like a late night one plus an early morning start. So what we need to do, right? The most unhinged one. I'm already envisioning the most unhinged episode we can have is post Demo Fest. Because I would have to get up early to actually get into London. We'll have the whole day of talking to people. And then we'll be out for drinks. And then we'll do the recording.
And then we'll do a recording the next day as well.
Oh, God. Oh, goodness. Oh, dear. But should we actually talk about pre-sales? Like, as a general... I have a topic within pre-sales. And it's...
Okay.
And it's I'm so happy I get to say this, because now, you know, because Paul got really giddy about this. But a friend of the show, Peter Cohen, of great demo fame, gave me the idea of a topic that I actually never really explored within pre-sales. But once he sort of explained it to me after a chat we had last week, actually, do you know, Paul, the Dunning-Kruger effect?
It rings a bell, but I'm gonna say. Lydia, you tell me about it so that listeners can understand.
In short, practically a cognitive bias, which means people with limited idea of what they can do, aka they not really understand their abilities, tend to overestimate their ability. And in practice, what that means is that people who know little think they know a lot. Or can do little, think they can do a lot. And... I just realized this is prime spot for me to offend a whole bunch of people. I do believe when your whole description as your role, speaking of descriptions and pre-sales, when your whole identity in your career is, the person who knows their stuff, or the technical expert, or the person who knows the product, etc., however you want to describe it, you always by default even if you are being as humble as you can be, you start believing that at a point, and you start to misconstrue exactly where you fit and where your abilities are in comparison to where you want them to be.
Mm-hmm.
By the way, I fell into this fallacy myself,
mm-hmm.
Especially, funnily enough, and not funnily enough, this is exactly what the effect is. When you know very little about a thing, you overestimate how much you know, and the more you know about a thing, the less you think you know. Mm-hmm. Especially in the context of pre-sales, this is, I think it's super dangerous because it makes especially long tenured pre-sales people really difficult to train.
Mm-hmm.
You can imagine this is exactly the field that I particularly care about, but also you, Paul, as a leader, this, now that I've sort of introduced this idea to you, do you start seeing how this can be really hurting your pre-sales team in the long run?
Yeah, definitely. And I just brought up the chart that we'll link to as you were talking, and I was like, yeah, no, I have definitely seen this before. It's very, yeah, and I think it's interesting because I did a whole thing with my team at the start of the year around confirmation bias and survivorship bias. And I think this is in that same kind of space.
Talk to me about the confirmation and the survivorship bias. Like, what did you talk about?
So, I would say that it's in a there's a couple of things. So I think when you're tenured in a position, so from a survivorship bias, for anyone that doesn't know, is when you're looking at the wrong kind of part of a problem. You're looking at the classic example is designing fighter planes, looking at which the planes that come, it's the meme that's all over LinkedIn, but it is also the thing that most people, when you say this, they go, oh yeah, I know what you're talking about. So for those folks that don't know, the story in short is that they were trying to design where to place armor on fighter planes, I think in World War II, and they were looking at, oh, these are all the areas where these planes have got holes in, and they said, we should arm those. And then an engineer said, well, no, you shouldn't do that because you're looking at the planes that have come back. You're not looking at the ones that haven't come back. So it's the ones that haven't come back that you need to be thinking about. So you're a good way of looking at that in pre-sales is if you look at, you know, oh, here's all the deals that we won. How do we win them? You're only looking at your things that have been successful. You're not looking at things that have not been so successful. And that was the kind of angle I went into the conversation with my team about, is saying,
mm-hmm.
we are, and this is not just in pre-sales, it's in sales, it's in human nature. You want to focus on your successes and kind of ignore the failures, but that is a fallacy because you actually might miss something. You miss an opportunity to change how you're doing something because you're only focusing on what confirms an existing belief, which is also where the confirmation bias comes in. And confirmation bias is where you have things that you believe, you have facts, the reality of things, and there's a Venn diagram, and in the middle of that Venn diagram is the fact that confirms things that you believe.
Mm-hmm.
And if you only focus on the facts that confirm what you believe, rather than looking at what's outside of that crossover, you will continue doing the same thing over and over and over again. And yes, you will have a degree of success in doing that, because there's always going to be a degree of success in the world of sales. And this may be a kind of a slightly controversial thing to say, but there is always going to be a foundational level of success that you will achieve by just doing the same. If you don't change how you sell, you will always have a level of success because it's a gamble, right? You're always going to, like, you can try, and it might be that you're winning one in every five deals, which 20% is a pretty low number. But because you're still winning, because that 20% is still allowing you to hit target every year, you're kind of going, oh, that's fine. I don't care about the fact that that 80% of the time I'm not succeeding. And it's a very dangerous thing to get into. And I think the message for my team is, like, you have to be hyper aware of what it is that you are doing and why it is that that has worked, and looking at things also in the round. And I always say, when you're doing an assessment of why anything worked, look at it in the round. I don't, Lydia, is it ever something that, like, when you were a field SE, did you ever think about why you had success? in a certain deal.
Whilst you were talking, especially when it comes to the survivorship bias, it's very interesting because I never, and boohoo me, I never thought about the successes. It was never, the successes sort of happened. It was like, okay, great. I was more focused on the failures and trying to see what I could have done differently to change. And even then, and but I'll be honest with you, Paul, I think especially, and this might be my own limiting experience of working for only one relatively big vendor, we didn't have the time to really dissect a deal. And it might be also, again, the type of customers I was covering, because I wasn't covering enterprise accounts. So one deal failing wasn't that big of a deal. It was a drop in the ocean, relatively speaking. So I was working, you know, relatively, you know, small to medium-sized deals with the occasional big one, but the occasional big ones didn't feel like they were in my control practically at all most of the time. So dissecting them and sort of looking back was very difficult from a deal perspective. It was easy to do on a per conversation perspective, right? I could sort of look at my latest conversation I had with a customer and go like, ooh, this is where I think things went sour, or this is where things went really good, you know. And I was also very lucky with my account manager because we had these conversations immediately after customer calls. And he would be also very cadent with me and saying like, yeah, this worked really well. Maybe do this one differently next time. And, you know, we could agree and disagree on the, you know, minutia of the feedback. But really dissecting deals using those two effects is really interesting to me. And I wonder if it's more of a leadership thing rather than an individual contributor. Did you used to do that as an individual contributor?
So I would probably do it, I think, similar to you, maybe more on an individual, like, action or engagement level. Like, if there was a particular call, a particular demo that went a certain way, I would with the account manager, I would have that, you know, that kind of follow-up. I was not tied to one particular account manager. I was worked with a different kind of several as an individual contributor, so it's a little bit different because everyone has a slightly different way of working. But I always tried to, at least, as you say, have that kind of conversation of, right, you know, how did that go? What went well? What could we do better? And even just doing that for myself, I think, would be the thing that I would try and do. It's a behavior that is driven top down, I think, in organizations. And as it's like, it's quite easy to go, oh, well, my organization doesn't do it, so therefore I never could. But actually, as an individual contributor, I think you can still, and it sounds like you were doing that, you can still look at what you did as an individual, the impact that you had individually, and every kind of small action that you take, and go, oh, did I get the desired outcome from that? And if I didn't, do I need to change something?
Would you, now looking at your team, would you advise them to continue doing what you and I have been doing as individual contributors? Okay, looking as it on a per individual, yeah, on a per conversation scale rather than looking at it as a deal.
Yeah, definitely. Because I think it's important to, I think you have to look at it on a decision basis as well. So when you, let's say you make a decision about a certain way that you're going to run a call, see how that plays out. You might make a decision about how you're going to approach a particular RFP response. You might think, in this one, we're actually going to try something a bit different. Because this applies as well, I think, to leaders, because you're not having as much direct engagement with customers as you do as an individual contributor. But you're still making decisions that will influence the direction that your team takes. And as a team member, you're going to make decisions that will influence how you approach an opportunity.
Would you, right now, especially, and I don't know how much you want to share about pretty much like the structure of the team that you're leading at the moment, but as far as you and I discussed, there are folks that are relatively, I would say, like, they haven't been doing this for 20 years. They're relatively...
It's a real mix. So I've got kind of some who have been doing it for a long time, in different companies and some in this company, and some who are like, I think the newest, this is maybe 2 years into it. So we're still relatively new.
Yeah. Do you see, So if we're talking about individual contributors focusing a bit more on, because again, I think it's very easy for us to nail the individual actions, right? Like the response to the RFP, the next conversation we're having with the customer, that's great. And it's easy for us to keep track of that. Would you recommend for them now to be, and because it is something that we speak about like in our little echo chamber of pre-sales, we talk about that pre-sales needs to be, individual contributors need to be far more aware of the deal cycle itself and how is it going, and the, you know, for us to be able to provide even more value than we already are. Would you ask of them now to look into the deal cycle itself a little bit more and to look as to why did we close this deal? Why did we not close this deal? Why was there no decision made at this time for this deal?
So I would. And I think personally my take on the future of the role is much more expansive. It's always been quite narrow in that we have been called on to do our thing, you know, get pulled in. Ah, this is Paul. He's going to come and do your demo, answer some technical questions, and then go away again. I'm already encouraging my team to look at the kind of whole deal cycle and to kind of, it's a bit of a cliche, but keep a finger on the pulse of it. And that may not be that you're actively speaking to the customer every day, but you should know what's going on in your deals, because yes, you're not maybe owning that step of the process, but it's still important to have an awareness about what's happening. And you know, again, friend of the show, Chris White, his thing, if you read his book, which you should, and hey Chris, you know, we're plugging this book, so you know, just hint. If you read Chris's book, he talks, and he has the introduction is something that I've told all of my team to read this book, by the way, and I would tell anyone, however long you've been in pre-sales, if you haven't read it, go and read it, The 6 Habits of Highly Effective Sales Engineers.
I have read it as well, by the way, and it was my window into the pre-sale space in a very, very big way. So genuinely, if we're at whatever point in your pre-sales career is like, let me echo Paul, do get yourself a copy of The 6 Habits of Highly Successful Sales Engineers. There are nuggets in there almost every single page in a very digestible way. And I'm so happy that you got this for your team, because it also helps for a, I guess, more unified approach to the same problems.
This book did, it opened my eyes and changed my perspective really significantly on the world of pre-sales. And it happened at a time when I was kind of going through this change in how I looked at this role, because I'd kind of been doing it in one company. I'd never really engaged other pre-sales folks. And it was actually just the way that Chris says, we're in sales. And I kind of was like, oh yeah, we are, aren't we? And I think that we talk so often about the technical stuff that we forget that this is a sales role, and that's a good thing, and you should embrace that side of your profession and the opportunities that brings with it. Not in the like icky, scammy used car sales person, and we know why that is a stereotype. It's a stereotype. It's a stereotype that gets pushed. And it's a stereotype that has been pushed in culture for a long time, and the stereotype of salespeople in films like Glengarry Glen Ross, which is the, you know, it's that like, oh look, I'm a CG salesperson, all I do is sell, or The Wolf of Wall Street, right, selling and scamming people. That's not what sales is, and it's certainly not what pre-sales is. And I struggle with the title solution consultant, because I think it's kind of meaningless. Because I think anytime you talk about a consultant, I'm like, well, a consultant's a doctor, or it's like rings of people that get brought into government, get paid loads of money, and then just produce lots of lovely PowerPoint slides.
Making friends today, are we?
We're not, no. But it's also, again, I think it comes back to that thing of, well, why why do we worry about what it is we call ourselves? And actually, it's what we think about is the impact that we have. And you're in sales because you're trying to position your product because you want people to buy it. But you're also still doing that because you have a belief that the product you're positioning can generally solve that problem. And that's not to mean that you're just a total kind of corporate shill, that you're, you know, you brought into the everything that you're everything and all for the company. But actually, I think you do have to be successful, particularly in pre-sales, I think, as well. You have to have an appreciation and an understanding of the value that your product brings to your customers. Otherwise, you just won't be successful at it. Because if you don't see the value yourself, you will not be able to articulate it to somebody else.
Or at the very least, you won't be able to. And again, if my description for pre-sales changes over time, but if I in my long form description of what a pre-sales person does, there is something in there about inspiring change.
Mm-hmm.
You need to be the person that when you're talking to customers in one way or another, you make them believe in the vision that you see for them.
Yeah,
being, you know, again, that's literally what inspiring means. And I think that's you can't inspire people about something that you yourself don't truly believe. If you're good enough actor, fair enough, you might be able to fake it to a certain degree, but it's going to weigh on you and you can only do it for so long. But genuinely, and in my experience, seeing other folks within VMware, within this space, like seeing other pre-sales people talk about their own products, which I would say I've seen competitors to VMware speak about their products with such vigor and such, again, and so much belief in it that I'm starting to believe them, right? And I'm the competitor. But they genuinely, and that was a huge compliment that I then told them afterwards, because to me, that is the epitome of what a good pre-sales person is. Like, you made my faith waver, let alone the customer that we were talking to, right?
Right.
And that's why, like, you know, maybe a topic for another day, but there were competition, you know, on the ground level where we as pre-sales are, it's not really that big of a thing, but don't. Anyway, you know, again, bigger topic for another time. But I was just thinking, like, as we were talking about folks, you know, the whole, like, oh, everyone in sales is rubbish, then realizing that, oh, I am in sales, and then realizing that actually everything is sales. That feels like a graph that most pre-sales people go through.
I was going to say, it's that, or it's the galaxy head meme, like getting into pre-sales.
Everything is sales.
Everything is, it's like ending. Everything is sales. It's a galaxy brain moment.
Brilliant. We've completely divulged away from the Dunning-Kruger effect.
We have.
But I think it really, as we were going down this rabbit hole, I just kept on thinking how many folks, and that's really, at least to me, that this is the scariest part. Was it you that said this about, like, you know, you can be 10 years in pre-sales, but, you know, you actually are 1 plus 9 years in pre-sales, where in reality, you've been doing the same thing you've done from the start and you haven't really improved, but you're just gathering up years. Thus, in a traditional sense, people assume you know more than you are, and then you assume you know more than you are. I constantly fear this point, by the way, that I will forget what it was like to not know anything. I live in constant, it's not a debilitating fear, but it is a big fear that I will forget what it was like to be new to pre-sales. And I don't know at that point, how am I going to be able to coach people and teach them about pre-sales?
I don't even remember our conversation. I think it might have even been on the first episode. And you were going through that, like, I don't know what I'm going to do mode. And I was, it's like I said to you, don't walk away from the field. Or, like, don't rule out walking away from the field. It's because of this. It's because I have been there, and I think I'm absolutely guilty of that thing in the Dunning-Kruger effect, and of you know, of all these biases where you come in and you have a bit of success, and you think, oh, I know this, but yeah, it's my fear as well as a leader that I'm going to forget what it's like to be out in front of customers every day and having a schedule which is very busy, and then I have my boss telling me, oh, you have to do this now and you have to do that now, and it's a real kind of fear. And I think the other thing, though, that attaches to this, and that this is probably also a conversation that we need to kind of have in subsequent episodes, is imposter syndrome. And I had something recently that made me laugh, but I was like, it's kind of true. And it's more people than you think have imposter syndrome, but the people that don't have imposter syndrome are the ones that probably should. And by that, it's when you look at certain public figures who you think you don't have imposter syndrome at all, but you really probably should. And you're stuck in that first peak of the Dunning-Kruger effect, where you have none of the knowledge but all of the confidence. And I will say that in pre-sales, but kind of in software more broadly, I do feel like the more that I have conversed with senior leaders and people in the C-suite, it's been refreshing how many people have gone, oh no, I'm still just making this up every day.
Yeah, I hear the same. It's amazing. We don't know if they are truthful, but it doesn't matter. The fact that I have the humility to at least make it up makes me feel very good about myself.
Exactly. And I think that I've always said in a kind of any kind of context of teaching, but also then in pre-sales, is that all you kind of have to do is stay one page ahead of the person you're speaking to, and you will sound like an expert to them.
Yep.
And yep. You're not, you don't have to know everything. And there's this, again, a thing that I've really been kind of saying to my team is like, you're not going to know everything there is to know. Certainly not as the company gets bigger, as the product scope gets bigger, you actually have to focus in on certain areas. And the best description that I've ever kind of seen of this for pre-sales people is being shaped like the letter T as a capital letter, which is that you have a very broad general knowledge, and then you have a topic which you can dive into in real detail. And that was one of the best bits of advice I was ever given, because I was like, oh, I don't have to know all this stuff. And even more as a leader now, I think for you being in enablement as well, when you kind of have a focus, you can't expect to know all the ins and outs of that. I can't expect to know all the ins and outs of the technical side of exactly what my product does, because that's where my team are then the experts that I defer to.
Yep.
And in the broader spectrum of pre-sales, it's like, I'm not going to know everything there is to know about all aspects of this function. For me, I'm really leaning into the overlap with the sort of the marketing side of it, because that, A, I really enjoy it, but I also think it's a really interesting growth area. But it's also just retaining that, hey, remembering, hey, I'm probably a bit ignorant and there's a lot of stuff I don't know, and just not being afraid of saying I don't know the answer to that and I need to bring somebody else in, because that's fine, right?
Yeah,
no one's gonna judge you for that.
I'm really happy you brought that up, because I do think whilst both you and I have the shared experience of being individual contributing pre-sales people in one way or another, I think leadership and coaching have something in common, which is that, and please don't take this the wrong way, Paul, but because it refers to me as well, you don't have to be the best pre-sales person to be the best leader of a pre-sales team, nor do you have to be the best pre-sales person to be able to coach people. And I spoke with someone about this, because that was the biggest, you know, with the conversations you and I were having, and a lot of the other sort of like other people that I was looking out for wisdom from, kept on telling me like, oh, maybe it's too early, maybe you shouldn't have made the jump into coaching, maybe you should have waited a little bit. But then at the same time, someone else said to me, people who coach baseball, like the best coaches of baseball, are not the best baseball players, they're the best coaches. And these are two completely different set of skills. And that immediately made me feel a lot better about the decisions I've made. And I hope you can take the same thing when it comes to leadership, because yes, you will forget what it's like to be an individual contributor. not completely, because you have to work with these folks a lot. Same as me, right? Like, we need to be open to experience, be empathetic to other people's experiences, but that's not our core set of skills anymore that we should be focusing on. I had to make that very conscious decision when I let go of my networking certification, because mm-hmm. that was not the core set of skills I wanted to have anymore. I'm always going to know networking. It's decaying and getting older, that knowledge. But that's fine, because that's not where I am the best at.
Mm-hmm.
I'm the best at making it, you know, making networking knowledge approachable to people, making pre-sales approachable, making people the best they can be. Your role is to make people, is to remove obstacles between you and between your team and what they're trying to achieve, and enabling them and giving them wings for them to spread and go.
Right, and I agree, and I think it's because coaching and leadership are distinctive skills that are separate to the sort of technical side of being in this role, and any role, right? They're on their own. They are traits and abilities which, again, this may sound a bit big-headed, but I do think it's true that there is a natural ability that underlies what makes someone a great coach and what makes someone a great leader. And I think it's also why you don't, the candidates for becoming a leader, for becoming a coach, the best candidates are not often the people that are longest tenured. And the best kind of split that I've seen of this recently is I've just finished reading a book called Radical Candor, which I would 100% recommend it for anyone in a leadership role. For individual contributors, it's targeted at, you know, people managers and people leaders, but there's probably still some interesting kind of information in there, and I would still suggest sort of checking it out and checking out the website. But the author of that, and she was, you know, a leader at Google, she worked at Facebook, worked at Twitter, very, very kind of high performing leader. And she defines this thing, you know, the differences between what she calls rock stars and superstars in organizations. And it's really interesting. I think it kind of plays a little bit into what we're talking about, which is that rock stars are the people who are very, very good at what they do. They like what they do, but they don't want to, like, progress. They don't want to reach the corner office, right? They're like, I'm a really, really strong individual contributor. You then have superstars, who are the people that are going on that rapid growth trajectory, who want to push themselves, who want to sort of change how things are done. They come up with ideas, and they're the kind of people who want to climb the organization, because the higher you get in the organization, the more leverage you have over change, making change. So I think it's an interesting definition, because kind of what we're talking about here of, like, your, and I think pre-sales is particularly strong for this. You don't have to define your kind of growth and your success in pre-sales as, oh, I'm moving up this trajectory. Because, yeah, like, you might be a rock star, and that might be where you focus on. But also, if you're someone who is super kind of driven by making a change, having an impact, and you're less interested in the technology itself, then there's also a kind of a growth, a personal growth route that way as well. So I think it's interesting, because you kind of don't want to lose that connection. And I think the fact that you and I are both aware that we don't want to lose that connection, I think is, again, sounds a bit big-headed, but I think that's probably what's going to keep us grounded, is the fact that we know that and we're aware of that, where I think it's when you're not aware of that risk that you then can maybe make decisions and say things that just people look at you and go, well, that's not relevant anymore.
What are you doing?
I'm making show notes.
Oh, are you?
Yeah.
I thought every single time when you do that is that you are chatting to people.
You think too little of me. No. I'm generally...
I'm so sorry.
Because, if I tell you, when I was listening to the episode yesterday, I did not have to change the show notes. All I had to do was write the little blurb, okay? And add some, I think I deleted, like, one thing.
Oh, that is... okay, never mind. I take it all back. I take it back. Take it back, sees. I feel so...
Why? Because I can hear you tapping. Are you talking to people?
I don't know if you can see. There is a script on Riverside, so I'm taking some things that you, as you're talking, I'm just taking notes on what I want to follow up on, because the conversation goes so naturally that I sometimes forget a point that I wanted to make, and I didn't want to interrupt you because you're making a really good point. So why would I want to interrupt? The point I wanted to make, you calling me out so much, is that RFPs are bullshit. And RFQs as well. You know, again, that's a very loaded statement. But the reason I wanted to bring this up is because at the moment I'm doing a big, I wouldn't say a big piece of work, a medium-sized piece of work around why infrastructure selling is different from SaaS selling. And I believe more so in infrastructure realm. And by the way, by infrastructure, I mean like networking, security, you know, cloud infrastructure, virtualization, you know, pretty much my realm until recently, is littered with RFPs and RFQs. Almost every single deal of a certain size, especially if you work in public sector, comes with an RFP. And I, in my time at VMware, so 3.5 years, I wrote, Paul, a single RFP. Or responded to a single RFP. And it was after a lot of crying from my side because I didn't want to do it. And surprise, surprise, we didn't win it. Because the people who post, so, you know, when customers post these RFPs and RFQs, I'm going to tell you a very dirty secret, which is it's not written by them. It's written by their preferred partner and our vendor to actually fit their requirements. And you can tell really easily by the language they use, because they use specific language for that one vendor. And the most annoying thing is, and you know how I know this? Because I used to write them. So I used to work for a partner organization. No. So I used to work for a partner organization, and we would pick, right? We would pick which vendor we want this customer to work with. And then we went out, we wrote the RFP, we took it to the customer, they agreed, because that's what they paid us for. And then we will go off to tender. And you would see everyone and their grandmothers respond to it. And it was a futile battle. Because you will never, at the point of the RFP being, or the RFQ being published, the decision has already been made as to who they want to work with. This is now just a formality, really. One of legal, especially if it's public sector, is down to legal. I don't know if I'm being, how controversial I'm being here. I might have to censor myself here.
I think, yeah. You're not... So I would say, having worked in the public sector, yes, that's how they're done. Because I used to write tenders and we'd have to send them out to the same three vendors, and 95% of the time, we would go with the preferred vendor. Now, in the software space, it's RFPs are more competitive, I would say. Certainly in my experience. In certain sectors, though, it's not that the RFP is even written by the customer or by a preferred vendor. It's actually written by a selection consultant, which, if you haven't come across selection consultants, are companies who essentially outsource procurement. And this is maybe a controversial thing to say, but I have decided that if I ever want to build a really steady, stable business that I can repeat doing the same thing, I will become a selection consultant. Because really, you get in with a certain sector and or a certain, you know, a certain sector and the vendors, and you know the vendors, like the top three or top five vendors in that space. You can essentially then go to companies and say, I will run your procurement process for you. I already have all of the RFP questions pre-written. I'll send them. I'll help you score the RFP based on the responses.
Jesus.
And my thing with RFPs is that going back to the last episode where we talked about Gen AI and the end of the internet, I really think it could be the end of RFPs. Or I think we're gonna get into a position where we have RFPs that are both written by and responded to by generative AI. And it's just
just robots exactly. talking to each other.
That is the end state of RFPs at the now. I have had experience of winning a blind RFP. Wasn't easy, but we did it.
Okay.
And I think that
okay, so hold on. Let me dig into this. Was it the RFP or was it the conversations you had around that process?
It was the outcome of the one I'm talking about in particular was probably the tightest RFP process I've ever seen, to the point where when we went to do the demo, we had 3 hours. They, at the 3 hour mark, they literally stood up and walked out of the room. We had finished and we were like in conversation mode, but the person leading the conversation went, right, that's it, 3 hours. And it wasn't like we didn't win it solely on the basis of the response to the RFP. No, but what the RFP was, and like any conversation, like any motion, like any action in the sales motion, you're just trying to get to the next conversation. You're just, it's never, and this is arguably, it's kind of an oversimplification, but I think it holds up broadly that in any selling conversation, in any, whatever it is, if it's a qualification, if it's a cold call, a qualification call, a demo, a discovery, an RFP, a negotiation, if you don't, you're always looking to get to the next call. That's there's always other next steps, there's always other outcomes you want to achieve. But crucially, you want to go, we're going to speak to you again tomorrow, because the conversation is then still going. And what you hope is that obviously you're progressing and you want those things to go quicker and you want to get to the close one quicker, but RFPs are, they're a tool in a cycle, and I think that, yeah, their usefulness is definitely overstated, and I think that different sectors have different uses for them.
You, listening to you, you are swaying me in the sense of, and again, because I haven't actually sold in the SaaS world in any way, shape, or form, right? In, I don't know how you would define a lot of the products I was selling with VMware, but, you know, let's say broader stroke, like I've never sold like the type of product that you, for example, are selling right now, Paul.
Right.
So I would imagine if there isn't a set of de facto vendors. So the easiest one for me would be just to go, you know, go back like one step in my career and go like networking, right? So Cisco and Juniper, that was usually the two, like the two vendors at the time that I was pitching for one way or another with an RFP. So in those moments, I can tell by the language they're using, because there are going to be some specific language. There would be sentences taken directly from their websites that I could recognize and say like, oh no, this is something written for people want Cisco, right? I'm not going to argue with them. Sure, fair enough, right? Or people want Juniper. Yeah, I'm also not going to argue with that. But there is no point in even having, there's no point in responding in a blind way saying, oh, but have you considered Arista, right? Like it's a completely different vendor. That's just not going to happen, right? Because these people don't really care about this, another vendor. They've already made their minds up when that specific language is used. And I think it's, I wonder if it's because in the infrastructure space, there tends to be these mammoth companies that take the majority of the space, versus when you're looking for something like, again, I'm very broadly speaking here, but let's say like an HR organization tool. You have Sage, but you also have 100,000 other ones that do different bits of Sage, a little bit better, a little bit worse, a little bit like this, a little bit like that, right? I wonder if then it has a lot more, a bigger impact in the total conversation. The one exception was when people were looking broadly at who even has the capacity to do this big project for us, right? So it wasn't even a technology RFP. It was more around, we're looking for a partner and then the kit to do the thing that we want. Whilst listening to you, it feels like software-based solutions are a little bit more flexible, where it feels like it's where RFPs are supposed to, in the way they're supposed to work, like, which is like, hey, we have these lists of requirements because of the things that we're struggling with right now with our current solution, or we're expecting to struggle going forward. Please tell us how your solution
Yeah, and that is what they do, but I would also say in my experience, so when I worked at IFS, we had three, maybe four main competitors. And it would be, you know, you'd have SAP, Epicor, Oracle, QAD, right? And those would vary, but SAP and Oracle obviously were always in there because, like, they were like the other two. So like the three vendors you could almost always guarantee that were in there in some way was IFS, SAP and Oracle. And you kind of end up having the same discussions. And I think that what's interesting in software is that with the exception of new sectors where you're kind of seeing hyper, like, big growth, like, say, like, demo automation, right, is a really good example, particularly in our world. There is an increase in those companies. So there would be real value in kind of, you know, doing an RFP, going out to those companies. Quite a lot of the time, in software, they are often a procurement formality, which I would just imagine is very similar in hardware. It's a step that it's a due diligence step that companies have to go through to show, hey, we're making a significant investment, therefore we need to demonstrate that we have done our due diligence with all these vendors, and then we've scored them, and then we've come with this output. And I think the other thing that it's worth saying here, and this is probably more unique to software, I should caveat, I haven't had experience of selling hardware. I've had experience of buying it, but not selling it. Mm-hmm. But the hardware refresh cycle, so the frequency with which you're going out and buying new hardware, is much shorter than buying new software. So when I was working in IT, we would refresh our hardware, like our networking hardware, our switches, every 3 to 5 years. That was the life cycle. So every 3 to 5 years, you're going out, you're buying new stuff. Software, 5, 10, 15 years, quite often. You don't make a software buying decision of that scale very often. So your buyer is often doing it for the first time. And that's perhaps where RFPs can have more value, because they genuinely have a list of problems they're trying to solve.
No, yeah, no, that's a perspective I never considered. Funnily enough, because again, I haven't really sold software in that sense of, like, end user facing software. Like, it's always been infrastructure. I never considered that it's such a long cycle. That is interesting. By the way, for the sake of, like, you know, making sure that it's a well-rounded conversation, there's three individual, I keep on using them interchangeably, which maybe I shouldn't. So there's RFI, there's RFP, and RFQ, right? So, and the way I understand the differences between the three is that the RFI is the initial one. It's just let's have a look-see of what is out there, right? And those are the ones I've always been more keen on responding to rather than anything else, because then it's still a sort of like getting a feel of what's out there at the moment in the world. So especially in the security space, when people were pushing out RFIs, I felt a lot better responding to those, because also there was a lot more of an open door, you know, to the end customer in the end of the day. The RFP was where I stopped, which is pretty much like the line that I stopped really caring unless I know who wrote the RFP and if they had us in mind as a vendor. Because again, as a partner, it was really easy to respond to RFPs because I worked with everyone, right? So I could read and tell, like, I know this language. I know who the vendor is. I'm gonna push this specific vendor that we are partner of, right? And we're gonna win that RFP. The RFQ then is the sort of the last one, and I think I've only done maybe two or three RFQs in its real sense, in the sense of, like, okay, a decision has already been made pretty much as to what we want, and now we're asking for specifics, or it's more of like the last stage of that process where they say, okay, top three choices, now you need to go deeper. We need to analyze you a bit better. We need to understand you a little bit better. My points of like, why I didn't like a lot of the RFQ processes is that, oh, you cannot talk to us. You need to do the Excel spreadsheet. It's like, no, but I want to talk to you, Mr. Customer. Like, I need to understand, why is this important to you? It's like, no. Excel spreadsheet, that's it. You genuinely, I had once in one of these processes, I was told, do not email the customer. And it was really difficult because I had a personal connection with this person. So we would have emails back and forth for other stuff. And I'm like, okay, should I not email mm-hmm. them at all? Or should I not email them about the RFQ? But what if the RFQ does bring up, you know, does get brought up as a part of the conversation? What do I do then? So I think it's just, and maybe, you know, maybe at some point we need to have a chat with someone within the procurement space.
Yeah.
I know you have a friend in procurement, and I don't know how much you've had a chat about these sort of things, but from the receiving end of that process, the dehumanizing elements of a sale, and it's so strange because the sale is human, right? There's a book written with that title. It is so fundamental to us being able to make a good decision is the human factor. And I know especially in public sector, right? And in an attempt to make it as genuine and as fair for everyone else, we have actually made it more unfair. Speaking of, I'm so happy that this time we're having a rant because being able to rant about a procurement process, yeah. about RFQs is not something I've been able to do in a very long time. I'm very happy that you're here, Paul, for this.
Yes, I do have a very good friend of mine who is in procurement, has been in procurement for over 10 years. And I've spoken to him before we even started this about when I was like kind of toying around the idea of doing a podcast. And he was like, yes, I would love to do it, but we'd have to do it in person. And I was like, that's fine. So when we can actually schedule to do an in-person one and we hire a proper studio in London, we'll get him along to come and do a special guest episode. Because I think that would definitely be a worthwhile kind of conversation to...
I already Adrian. Have a title. What was his name, sorry? Adrian. Adrian Villaria, RFP match.
It would be funny because there's also another friend of Michael Sebastian who... He's now a IT contractor, but he regularly texts me going, I'm sat on a pre-sales call and it's rubbish, or variations of that. And he's like, and it's just like, so prime examples of just, I don't want to say too much about the sector he's in, but he's just like, it's like sort of trying to sell a car seat to someone who doesn't have children. It's like some of the things he encounters. It's like, he's like, you haven't even listened to my requirements. He's like, I'm telling you, I don't have this thing that you're trying. I don't even, you're trying to sell me a system for something that I don't even have. That I don't even have a need for. Ooh. But you're still like trying to keep me on the call. And it's that kind of stuff that I just, it's like when I see cyclists riding down the road without a helmet, cutting in between cars, and I'm like, you are the reason that people hate cyclists. I'm like, it's people like that that go, yep. You are the reason people hate salespeople because you give us a bad rap.
I wish, you know those things that regularly get asked on Reddit, like if you can say one thing into mm-hmm. people's brains, like if you have like, you know, a sentence that you can share with everyone in the world, what would it be? And I feel mine would be something, I haven't practiced it or anything, so it's not going to be a particularly succinct sentence, but it's going to be something along the lines of, if you are selling for a living, which by the way, most of us are sellers in one way or another, you're either selling yourself or you're selling your product, please, 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 the one thing and the one thing only that you need to make sure of is that you actually freaking listen to the person you're trying to sell to. End of sentence. Thank you.
Absolutely. No, my coda to that is, everybody is in sales. Or at least most people are.
I think everyone is in sales. Any role. Oh, okay, debate.
If you work for a company that sells something, you are in sales.
No. Okay. I'm broadening this up, right? It's not in the sense of like you are selling to people, but you're selling something. in every single aspect in your life, you're selling something. You're in a relationship. You've sold yourself to this person, right? You have managed to position yourself in such a way that you have now sold... by the way, this argument is something very dear to my heart because this is a very common argument between me and my partner. Because when I moved to pre-sales, his immediate reaction was like, ah, you've sold your soul. It's like, hold on a second. This is not, you know... But by the way, at the time, I did get affected because I was thinking... I thought he was right. But since then, I've changed my opinion very drastically, where you have a job, right? You have been hired by any company, whatever, right? You're a nurse, you're a doctor, you're a daycare person. You have sold yourself to your employer. Congratulations,
yes. You're in sales.
There's nothing icky about sales, right? Not we're not freaking used car dealership salespeople, right? We're not... This is, and I don't know why this is a thing. Oh, no, I know why this is a thing, because you have people like what your friend was describing, which is like, how can you sell? And that's why I'm saying the one thing you need to do is actually listen to the people you're selling to. Rant over. Good topic.
It's a good topic, yeah. I think final thing I would say final thing for this one on pre-sales, and I was interested to know your opinion on this. I think that pre-sales and SEs, SAs, SCs, whatever you want to call us, are the best placed people in any company to drive change and to drive adoption of change. And that is for a few reasons, but at its core, it's because our role is all about selling the value of doing something differently.
Oh, my reactive response was going to be no, because that's not where corporations tend to put the value. But when you added that last bit about we are best placed to inspire change, really, within other organizations, why are we not doing it for our own as well? And the reason, to explain my reasoning about the initial reactionary no, it comes down from the coaching side of things, where... Even for pre-sales teams to get budgets for enablement for their own team, it needs to get approval from sales team, which to me is, you know, mind-boggling. It's like it's not mind-boggling in the sense of like, oh, I understand why that happens. It's because of the structure where the leadership team of the pre-sales organization would sometimes be under sales, thus they need to get sales approvals, etc. But it feels like overall, pre-sales have taken this role of we are here to serve a specific purpose, and that is to provide value to the sales team. Whilst in reality, they do have the power to change the broader organizational direction on how to make that happen. I wonder, Paul, well, you are a leader in pre-sales. What's stopping people from being like that? Is it are we not being loud enough? Are we not being effective enough? Is this the whole... And I think you know my opinion on this, of like, you know, do we have a seat at the table to be having these conversations? So my overall answer is, I do think we're best positioned, exactly because we do have the skill sets, both as leaders, as individual contributors, to do that change. But then it's about like, are we actually going to do it? Why should we do it? What are the benefits for the individual person, right?
I guess your initial no, right, which is totally fair, and I do think that this role is still undervalued in organizations, but that, and I can't think of a good analogy, but there is no point in waiting for someone to give you permission to try and change something, because it will never happen. Now The challenge, and I think there's kind of those, the budget conversation is completely fair, and that is where, like, for me as a leader, I'm a big proponent of training, and that is for a leader, it's for you to go and evangelize and fight for and justify why your team should have training, because that's actually a pre-sale, that's pre-sale skill, that's internal selling, right? Because you're saying, hey, make this investment and here's going to be your return. And I'm not saying that it's going to be an easy thing to do, but that's on my fellow pre-sales leaders. We need to be the ones advocating for budget for our teams to be trained. as an IC, how can you initiate change, and how have I done it? Because I think it's all well and good saying, oh, change isn't. I have done it on a number of different, in a number of different ways, whether it's bringing in new technology, whether it's changing internal processes, whether it's getting people to look at things in a different light. You just have to be bold. And I think you're right to do. I think we do have to be louder about it. And I think we do have to be persistent about it. And we have to maybe tap into some of those sales skills that conventionally we wouldn't do, right? We don't conventionally do cold calling, prospecting, qualification, negotiation. We maybe need to start doing a bit of that, right? Because you're look at it as an internal sale that you're trying to do. But if you have, you know, if you've identified a gap in your organization, you're going, hey, look, if we actually did this, it would be really helpful. Then speak to your manager. And I've said the same thing to my team. I'm like, if you have ideas, and we've already had some already that are really, really great. And I'm like, if you have stuff that you think we should be doing, come to me and I will back you to the hilt to get that done. Because if you can see what, and quite often when you actually go to more senior people in the organization and say, hey, I've got this idea. Sure, they won't always go with it. But in my experience, quite a lot of the time they'll go, that's a brilliant idea. We never would have thought of that, because they aren't connected to the day-to-day in the way that you are.
But also I want to put a caveat on that, as someone who, as an individual contributor, has spoken to leadership with many of ideas, go with them with a solution, not a problem. I think I know it's a well-known thing, but just as that's the most important thing. You go with, this is the problem I've identified, this is how I would fix it, and this is what specifically I need from you, Mr. Leader, and how do I actually get it going?
Well, I need your help to help me get it going.
Yeah, to get this specific thing, right? This specific action from you that I know you can do because of your role, or maybe you can get me talking to someone else who is able to do this. I love playing devil's advocate, and there's just two things that I was listening to you, Paul, that came to mind.
You
know, as because it was a little bit of a call. It was a little bit of a call to action, really, to individual contributors. But two problems, right? One, why the heck would I do this? I get paid. I don't get paid from this. This is not something that I particularly care about. I'm having my demos. I'm having my deals. I'm, you know, even better, I am an SE that's already quite involved in the overall sales process, right? I am becoming a trusted advisor. I am being this person that everyone wants me to be. Now you also want me to be it as part of a change within an organization and to lead that? No, thank you, right? So that's going to be your first struggle, I imagine, as a leader of people, of motivating people to care about the company overall. Because mind you, like, I've had my leadership also ask me, like, oh, if you have any feedback, let me know. Or if there's anything you would like for us to change. The way that I found the things that matter to me was literally that. Like, what are my day-to-day issues? What are the things that are hurting me in my day-to-day? Is it Salesforce, right, that we're using as a CRM? Is it the process that we're doing that? Is it my relationship with my account managers? Is it my relationship with the development team and me not having access to them? Like, that communication channel. Whatever. And by the way, like, these are actual examples from my, you know, 3.5 years at VMware. These were all things that I identified as this is genuinely making me mad throughout the day. What is my solution to this problem? Okay, it's one-sided entirely because they don't know the other person's perspective. But let me think about this, try to find an ally.
Couple
in
of
the
things,
other
I think. And the first thing, I think you made a very good point about going with a solution, not a problem. Because the question that I ask my team when they come to me with stuff, and the question that my leadership asks me, and every level that you go to will always ask is, how can I help? And that's where you have to think about it. And I think it's actually worth, it's not just when you go to leadership, it's if you go to another department with a problem, if you're going to your product team with a problem, if you're going to your sales ops team with a problem, they're going to say, okay, how can I help? And you have to have a really good answer to that and go, here are the tangible things that we can change. Here's why, and here's what I think is involved. Why would you do it? I think you kind of answered your own question. Are you telling me that if you're telling me that you're completely happy with how everything works in your company and in your role, in your day-to-day, I'm not going to believe you, right? There's going to be something. And whether it's going after, hey, we're not using demo automation, or we're manually responding to RFPs, or we're going to all these trade shows and we're focusing, you know, we're not actually kind of really explaining to people what it is we do. We're putting out marketing material, but I think I could add real value. Again, real examples that I've done and am doing. And finding the right person to go to in the organization, looking at it as a sales process, because you might go to five different people in five different departments and only two of them actually take you up on it. But those are then two people who have said, yeah, let's do it. And I think work with your manager, work with your leaders, work with your team, because there's only ever, and I have said this repeatedly to my team, I'm like, I am only going to have a very limited spectrum of ideas for stuff that we can do. So I need you to come to me with these things. And I need you to be open to the fact that I might have suggestions of how you do it differently. I can't say that we'll definitely do it. But even better, right, if you're coming to me and saying, I think we should put together a cross-departmental team to work on this specific issue. Hey, you know what? That doesn't have a cost attached to it. If you're saying you're willing to run it, pull it together, probably going to get off the ground, right? I think this is definitely something that we could continue to talk about for a very long time. And I have thought about it, as you put it, I have thought about it a lot. And it's something that I have, I'm still working on how to articulate, because I genuinely believe though that we are, in our department, we can have a transformational impact on how companies run. We just need to give ourselves the voice and have that belief, right? That, you know, yes, you don't know everything, but you probably know more than you think, and you need to put that into play when you're trying to execute change internally.
I will leave this conversation, Paul, with a little bit of a cliffhanger. And a request for folks to engage with us, and for you to also have a think about, you know, what do you do in this situation when your pre-sales team says, specifically around the Dunning-Kruger effect, I am so good already, why would I do anything? And leave it at that.